accession number 17394, Reel 2.
Admiral Garrett's Reel 2.
Lord Mountbatten gave the order to turn, and this has been heavily criticised as it laid us open to attack by the torpedo attack by the German destroyers. And they had a considerable speed advantage, so having had this success, they made off. And later on, when we continued with this patrolling activity in the channel, the Admiralty reinforced us with a tribal class destroyer, which had an extra 6 knots on a hot speed we could do. HMS Punjabi came and joined us. But I just ought to explain that we then were attacked by a German aircraft while we were standing by the Javelin waiting for tugs to arrive, and then we escorted the tugs into Plymouth. And as I recall, we were going into Plymouth in line ahead, and we, was the junior ship, were last in the line, and a mine again exploded on our port side. On our port side, the point I'm making is that there were other ships ahead of us, and it seemed to be always at Jersey that attracted these explosions. But at that time, as will be known, the mining system involved time counts by which the mine could wait until 1, 2, 3, 4 ships had passed overhead before it became active. So it could have been a time count as well. We then were detached from the... there was another heavy raid in Plymouth at that time. And one can remember lying out in the Sound when we were duty destroyer and hearing the pieces of shell splinter falling into the sea alongside the ship as if it was raining. And we'd noticed the same phenomenon when we were in the dock in London, that although there were bomb explosions which were quite easily recognisable, there was also this clatter of splinters on the corrugated iron roofs. So it was not a very good idea to be out unless you were wearing a steel helmet, because you never knew what was coming down at that time. It was very sad to see the dilapidation in Plymouth, Devonport particularly, due to these raids, which were quite serious. We then were detached. HMS Jersey and HMS Jupiter were detached to join Force H at Gibraltar. We really looked on this as a summer holiday because the conditions, of course, in the Western Mediterranean were a great deal more agreeable than they were in the Atlantic and the Channel. We took part in the bombardment of Genoa, which was a thoroughly successful action in the sense that the force bombarded the port of Genoa and did some damage to the port installations and no doubt to the shipping there. And the aircraft from Ark Royal bombed La Spezia, which was another naval base. And we came back with no loss, except, I believe, in the aircraft squadrons. And we were cheered very lustily into harbour by the garrison of Gibraltar, who were probably very glad of a distraction from their rather tedious life trapped on the rock. We then rejoined the flotilla in the UK, but it was rather an extraordinary passage because there were 14 destroyers were detailed to escort HMS Resolution, which had been damaged. The battleship Resolution had been damaged in the attack on Dakar, and we escorted her home at a rather stately pace, about 10 knots. And I'd been on watch when we were leaving Gibraltar and found the ship extremely difficult to steer. And I asked the First Lieutenant what he thought, and he thought it was just we were manoeuvring at that time rather slow speed. But when we got towards home waters, another group of destroyers came and joined us, and the Mediterranean group went back down south. And we were at the tail of the line, and we were sent off to Dartmouth to signal our progress to the Dartmouth signal station so that we didn't have to break WT silence. And no sooner had we headed off at 28 knots than the alarm bells rang, and we went round in several circles, and the steering gear had broken down. So we managed to put this right, and then the same thing happened again, and the same thing happened again, and eventually we rejoined the force going up the channel towards Portsmouth, and saying we are steering with difficulty, which was quite an understatement. Anyway, we were ordered to lie off the Nab Tower, and we were picked up by a tug and taken into Portsmouth. And when we were docked, it was apparent that our rudder had fallen to pieces. The centrepiece had fallen out, and the two sides had twisted upwards, so that we were steering on two bits of twisted metal rather than the properly manufactured rudder, and therefore we had to go into dock. So once again we were in dock, and because the arrival of the Resolution brought the number of battleships there to three, the Germans thought this would be a good opportunity for bombing. So we were in Portsmouth for the March blitz on Portsmouth, and we had a very heavy raid involving our particular area. I was the only officer on board as duty officer day, and we practiced having a fire not on board but in the shed alongside the ship. And we did that at 5 o'clock, and by 6:30 or 7 o'clock we were doing it in real earnest, because that's exactly what happened. The shed alongside the ship was set on fire, and there were several bomb hits in our vicinity, so there was a lot of material flying through the air. But more important than that was that our dock started to flood up, so I had to report that our dock was flooding up, and the Commander Chief's headquarters said, well, have you got any holes left in the ship? Well, it happened that the senior dockyard officer responsible for our ship, foreman of the yard, had said that he was going to block up all the holes in the ship overnight, which was just as well, because the dock did flood up. We were actually floating when the officers started to come, and the ship's company started to come on board at 8 o'clock in the morning. But it was quite successful, and I actually got a mention in Portsmouth General Orders, so that was a satisfactory outcome. We were then refitted, and we rejoined the flotilla at Plymouth, just in time to go out to the Mediterranean as a reinforcement for the destroyers at Malta. We went to Malta in company with HMS Manxman, and HMS Manxman was ordered to act independently. It was very we were quite crestfallen when the signal was made, because she then shot away from us, and we thought we were going at quite a high speed, which is Lord Mountbatten's practice, and she just left. The Manxman was a very fast ship, fast mine there. Anyway, we finally made it to Grand Harbour, and we were then moved into a steamer creek where we lay for a few days, with of course a series of raids going on. And a curious thing happened that I never quite understood. The ship's company, except for the duty part of the watch, were landed each night and were told to take shelter ashore. I admit there wasn't very much one could do in the way of anti-aircraft fire, because the attacks were not close range. But anyway, we were in various shelters ashore, and when one came back on board, I remember we were walking down and there was a mine suspended by its parachute. There's a parachute gently tearing it, being torn by the fig tree into which it had landed, and so we proceeded on board a little more rapidity after that. Finally, we went out one evening to pursue a convoy which was going from Sicily to North Africa. We didn't catch it. And as we were entering harbour, it was a Kelly leading, we were fourth ship of the line on this occasion, two of our flotilla mates were lying off with HMS Gloucester, and our yeoman was just asking what our berth was going to be when there was an enormous explosion and we were blown in half. And I went to see what, as had happened on previous occasions, I went to see what the situation was as far as the motorboat and the skimming dish, the little fast motorboat we had were concerned, and the whaler. And I could see that the whaler had been smashed and that the skimming dish was suddenly shot out of the water by some extraordinary means. And they went back and reported to the captain. And then he decided to abandon ship, and we just walked down the ladder into the water. I was picked up by a dicer.
A dicer.
It's one of the local craft at in Malta. DGHAISA, dicer. And so that was the end of my service in HMS Jersey. We stood rather melancholy group on the customs house steps, covered in oil fuel. And if you tried to light a cigarette, it was black before you could get the thing alight. There's a fuel pouring down one's face. We were then taken across to HMS St. Angelo, where they gave us all a tot of rum and washed us in petrol, which I can assure you is quite a painful performance in the more delicate parts. And we were fitted out with duffel coats and old-fashioned army uniform, heavy serge uniform. And that's what we had for the time being. I think we had a pair of vests and pants each. But of course, the stock of clothing and so on was not enormous, and inroads were being made quite regularly, no doubt, by people surviving like us.
This appears to have been early May 1941.
2nd of May. Within a few days, some more destroyers arrived, and they took groups of our survivors, including me, to the westward, and others were taken eastwards to Alexandria. Our first lieutenant, Lieutenant Shaw, for example, went to Alexandria, and where he found himself in HMS Kipling, one of our old ships, and he helped pick up survivors from the Kelly, and eventually took over the as first lieutenant of the Kipling, because the first lieutenant was killed when the Davids collapsed, picking up survivors. However, let me just go on to the... We had a quick passage to Gibraltar. We then remained in Gibraltar as groups of survivors until HMS London was detailed to take us home. And there's an important naval construction point here, because 500 survivors were put on board this ship, which you may think is a considerable number. Well, fortunately, the counter-class cruisers were built to carry a battalion of troops on the China station, reinforcing Wei Hai Wei to Hong Kong or whatever, and that many of these counter-class crews had served on that station. Anyway, 500 survivors. We set off, and the Bismarck came out. There was a Bismarck chase. We were diverted from the escort duty of looking after one of the Union Castle ships to go and join the search, but before we'd got anywhere significantly, we were diverted, as I said earlier, to hunt for supply ships. But the point, just to complete this, is that the surgeon commander, the doctor of HMS London, wrote a book about his experiences, and he mentioned that he was in the London, but he made no comment on the fact that he had 500 survivors on board. And what is more, when we'd sunk the two supply ships, we had 200 prisoners, as well as the 500 survivors. And yet, so hygienic were these ships that it hadn't made any significant impact on the doctor's mind that he'd got a very large, just the population of the ship was about doubled. And I've always thought this was a very remarkable matter.
Where did the London eventually take you to?
Glasgow. I'd like, if I might, to divert for a moment onto a short sequence. It sounds like a name-dropping sequence, but it's quite amusing. When I was doing my destroyer time in HMS Mashona, we were lying at Portland, and one afternoon, Captain Lord Louis Mountbatten came on board and gave a demonstration of his new station-keeping gear, a sales talk. Our captain was a gunnery officer, not a dyed-in-the-wool destroyer captain, and he was rather taken with this new piece of equipment, although veteran destroyer captains dismissed it as a useless bit of kit that they could do equally well in their own heads. So consequently, Midshipman Gerrits got his first sight of Lord Louis Mountbatten.
What impression did he make on you?
Well, I'd like to pursue it, if I may. At that time, I was very interested in the way in which he presented the technicalities of this piece of gear, which he had himself invented. And in due time, I found myself using it in that ship and in subsequent ships as I served in. It was an ingenious addition to the bridge equipment, and the idea was that it would enable the watchkeeper, the officer watch, to tend to his duties with less distractions than he might otherwise have had. But I'll deal with that at another time. The point of the matter is that in 1940, when I was attached to the 1st Guards Brigade, I was with the 2nd Battalion of the Coldstream, and their commanding officer assembled us all in the officer's mess one day, and we were introduced to Captain Lord Louis Mountbatten, whose destroyers were at Immingham, a few miles away, and he'd come on a visit to the battalion to see how we were getting on. And by that time, I had been ordered by the brigadier to wear khaki uniform and not naval uniform in the beach area. And so I was dressed in khaki battle dress, and I was introduced to Lord Mountbatten as this, though you may not know it, is a naval officer. And so Sub-Lieutenant Gerrits then met Lord Mountbatten. And 2 or 3 months later, I was in HMS Jersey in the 5th Destroyer Flotilla, and when we were sunk off Malta, Lord Mountbatten stood up on a bollard and address the survivors exactly as you saw in the film of In Which We Serve. No card stood up on a box in a shed addressed to ship's company of HMS Kelly. Well, we'd had the same experience precisely in Malta in reality. I got home to Glasgow, travelled down by train to London wearing a borrowed uniform, and went straight to Gives the tailor, in which was then in Piccadilly, having been bombed out of Bond Street. And there, who should I meet but Captain Mountbatten? And he asked me what I would like to do next, and I told him that I wanted to go into combined operations, although I didn't really know exactly what the title was. I explained what I wanted to do, and whether he had anything to do with it or not, 10 days later I was up in Scotland with a whole lot of blunt-nosed craft nosing round Loch Fyne. And in fact I have two telegrams, one which ordered me to report to Commodore Warren at Inverary on the 2nd of August 1941, and another telegram which tells me to report to the senior officer of Salt Ships and Craft in March 1943, and the senior officer of Salt Ships and Craft was actually Admiral Warren. And those two telegrams had to serve as my appointments for the 3 years I served in combined operations. But come November 1941, I was happy to stand on deck of the hard transport Ettrick and greet Commodore Lord Louis Mountbatten when he came on board after he'd been appointed as Commodore Combined Operations. As you know, he subsequently became Chief of Combined Operations and took the rank of Vice Admiral, Lieutenant General and Air Vice Marshal, Air Marshal, to carry out his duties. And in 1943 I was home from abroad. I'd been abroad on the Madagascar operation, and I got two letters, and I was sitting in my office in Port Glasgow, and one told me to report to the naval officer in charge at 9 o'clock the following morning, or 9 o'clock in the morning on a certain date, and the other was a letter from Lord Mountbatten congratulating me on getting a DSC. And I looked at these letters, and they'd taken a year to get to me. So the letter was letter reporting to the naval officer in charge, he'd had a whole year to wait, and I still wasn't there because the naval officer in charge was in Bombay and I was in Glasgow, or on the Clyde. I'm still going on to this because it doesn't break. I saw Lord Mountbatten once or twice in the intervening years, but in 1959 he was going round the fleet saying goodbye on ceasing to be the First Sea Lord, and he gave instructions that he'd like to see chiefs and petty officers in different centres around the country, and I was in Portsmouth, and the chiefs and petty officers were to be assembled in their mess and the officers in their mess at Portsmouth Barracks, those who had served with him at different times, and it was necessary to make out a list making clear where you had served with him. When I saw the list submitted from my establishment, I noticed that he had not, the list did not include my service in HMS Jersey in the 5th Flotilla, and I told the secretary that this would cause an uproar, and he said, "Oh, I'm sure he'll never notice," And I said, well, would you want to bet? Anyway, we gathered in the wardroom of HMS Victory, and Lord Mountbatten duly came into the wardroom, great, enormous room, and he walked straight across the room and came up to me and said, have you got a brother? And I said, yes, I had. He was actually working with Lady Mountbatten in the St. John's Association. And he said, well, who is that chap who served with me in the 5th Flotilla? And I said, it was me. And he said, it wasn't on your list. So my bet was won. That was typical of the homework that he'd done. There may have been various tricks associated with it, but it was a result of hard work as well as skill. And subsequently, he did the same round when he was ceasing to be Chief of Defence Staff. And by this time, my wife and I were out in Singapore, and we were amongst those invited to meet the Chief of Defence Staff at Command House, where the Unified Commander-in-Chief had his headquarters. And we were wandering around the gardens with our friends when one of the ADCs summoned us to go and talk to the Chief of Defence Staff. And I said, well, he didn't really want to meet me, I'm sure. But anyway, when I arrived up with my wife to be presented, he was telling the story to his daughter of how he had met me wearing khaki uniform, and he said in my hearing that he was introduced to me, I was introduced to him, by the commanding officer whose name was Bootle Wilbraham. And I thought that was quite a phenomenal act of memory on his part. Right. Now, just to recapitulate a bit more about Colonel Bootle Wilbraham. When I was in the officers' training corps at school, we used to go to camp, and I remember the first time I was at camp, and I don't suppose I was any more than a cadet then, hadn't reached the dizzy ranks of corporal. We were all formed into a battalion, several school contingents made up a battalion. Our battalion was commanded, in fact, by Major Bootle Wilbraham. And the chaplain in charge, who took prayers at the appropriate time in this parade, was Chaplain Third Class Victor Pike. And I remember quite clearly because I remember the Sergeant Major's voice, but also the fact we had to say the Lord's Prayer three times because it wasn't sufficiently vociferous. The following year, I had been promoted to corporal, and with two sergeants from the OTC, I went to a course of instruction at the London School of Instruction at Albany Street Barracks. And we were under the supervision there of an officer of the Coldstream Guards called Lieutenant R.C. Hill. So you can imagine it was quite an amusing coincidence that when I was attached to the 1st Guards Brigade and the 2nd Coldstream, that the commanding officer should be Colonel Bootle Wilbraham, and the officer commanding headquarter company should be Major R.C. Hill. And subsequently, when we were in Scotland the following year, I